He was the prom king at Wade Hampton High School. He was the quarterback of the football team. He dated the prettiest girl, and he was always this kind of, he was nice until he wasn't.
Hey y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson, and from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound, conversations with people from all walks of life about how the South shapes who they are and what they do. You know the basics of the Alec Murdaugh saga, a disgraced attorney from small town South Carolina, convicted of murdering his wife and son, and now serving life in prison. That story has been the subject of countless news stories and TV segments and a couple of documentaries. But you've never heard it the way Valerie Borlein tells it. Valerie covers the South for the Wall Street Journal, and she covered the Murdaugh case from nearly its beginning. She's now written a book about it called The Devil at His Elbow. Not only does her book have new details about the case, it opens wider doors into the Murdaugh family history, a tale of power and fraud that goes back 100 years. Her reporting and writing shows how all that history led to a fateful day on the vast family estate when Alec Murdaugh decided the only way for him to survive was to kill his wife and son. Here's our conversation. This seems to me to be, among other things, the story of a place, Hampton County, South Carolina. It's the Low Country, but it ain't exactly Charleston. Could you sort of describe for folks what Hampton County, the setting for this story, is like?
You know, Hampton County is a major character in this story. And it is the Low Country, but like you said, it's not Prince of Tides Low Country. It is the back country or the up country. It's very swampy. It's a just vast expanse of land. So you have hundreds and hundreds of square miles where most people, the population density is very low. So people live, you know, a mile or more from one another in many places. It's hard to say that time forgot it, but it is just far enough from the big cities that there's not a lot of that kind of spillover prosperity like you would have outside of Charlotte or outside of Raleigh, where I live. And it's an hour from Charleston. It's an hour and a half from Columbia. It's very isolated and very kind of its own island in a way.
There were two things that you wrote about it that sort of struck me. One is that the population it had in 1920, which was about 20,000 people, was roughly the same as the population it had in 2009. So it did kind of, you know, people-wise, kind of freeze itself in amber over those years. And the other thing was, I'd never heard of anything like this before. At one point, basically, the entire county, like, had a fence around it. Is that right?
Yeah, there was literally a fence around Hampton County. And part of that is a function of topography. It is a place where the soil is not as rich as down in Charleston and Beaufort. So the perversity of having rich soil is that you have lots of cotton, lots of rice, and lots of indigo. And so therefore, there are a lot of plantations and a lot of the legacy of slavery is very, very dense and very well, you know, very still felt there. Hampton County is a little different. It's very swampy and the soil that's there is not as lush. But one thing it was very good for was grazing cattle. So 100 years ago or 200 years ago, there were lots of horses and cows and they roamed pretty freely. And as you come into the 20th century, you know, in Hampton County, like the American West, there was a debate over fencing and, you know, the old song, "Don't Fence Me In," is it the obligation of a farmer to fence out livestock from grazing or is the obligation of a rancher to fence in their livestock? That debate was raging in kind of the southeastern part of South Carolina. The neighboring counties were like, Hampton County, stop sending your cows over our line into the farms. And they got really kind of mad about it. And so they solved the issue in a unique way that I'm aware of in the South. They built a fence around the entire county anytime that there was a road in or out. And so it worked for a little while. But the problem with that is the advent of the automobile. And I didn't know this either, but like AAA literally started as amateur car enthusiasts who would drive their cars on the weekend recreationally and try to map out where the roads were. And so you would come into Hampton County on a road and there, you know, there'd be a fence and you'd have to get out, open the fence, drive through and close it. And it became a real problem in the 20s and they finally dismantled it. But isn't that stunning? I mean, it was such an on the nose metaphor for a place that really is isolated by geography, but also by choice in some respects.
So story, not just of a place, but obviously of a family, the Murdoch family. And I think one thing your book does that I've not seen elsewhere is sort of go back before Alec Murdaugh and trace the history of that family in its legal and illegal and extra legal ways. I know I'm about to give you an impossible task, but could you do the best you can to kind of briefly sum up the family history of the last 100 years of the Murdaugh?
I will do my very best. I should probably set the table by noting that, you know, we're talking in North Carolina, but Hampton County is a place where General Sherman marched through in two flanks, 65,000 troops at the end of the Civil War, and burned everything down. You cannot exaggerate the devastation that took place in Hampton County, a place that didn't have much anyway, but houses and churches. I went to pull records from the 1800s and they would say, well, you know, it's a burned county. Those records are gone. And so the legacy of that, it's almost like Dresden or Normandy. It's a place where there's a fundamental story that changed the trajectory of the place. And it still felt when the Murdochs moved there in the 1880s, Hampton County had actually, at the end of Reconstruction, has seceded from Beaufort County, which was predominantly Black and the last bastion of Republicans or kind of reformers after Reconstruction. Hampton County seceded. They got permission from General Wade Hampton, who was the governor at the time, to form an expressly, quote unquote, white county. They really did. They petitioned the legislature to be a white county. And he gave his blessing. He actually came down and laid the cornerstone of the courthouse himself, the Hampton County Courthouse. They established the leadership structure that was established there was the Confederate Old Guard, a lot of retired Confederate officers, including Josiah P. Murdoch, who moved his family there. He had been a veteran of the Confederacy and was going blind and older later in life. And he moved there to kind of start again. And that was Alec's great-great-grandfather. So the Murdochs moved to Hampton County in 1887. His youngest son is Randolph Murdoch, eventually senior. And he goes off to law school at USC, the only person from any of the five counties of that area to go to law school. He comes home and he sets up office and he's immediately a powerful, well-regarded, well-loved lawyer in town. He starts a law firm in 1910. In 1920, they create a new district attorney's office or solicitor's office, they call it there. He ran for solicitor and became kind of suddenly the main lawman for the five counties that were down in that area. And what was fascinating to me, and I had not fully thought through, in those days, like a rural county like Hampton, you'd have one sheriff and maybe a part-time deputy, maybe a jailer. But the jailer would tend to live in the jail and just operate it, which means that the solicitor is the finder of fact. He's the detective. If there's a homicide or he interviews victims, if there's an accusation of rape, I mean, he was the finder of fact and decided who to charge and who not to charge, which made him a very powerful man. And so Randolph Murdoch Sr. kind of became the big power broker in the Low Country in 1920. He held that position until 1940, and his family continued on to hold that office for roughly 100 years.
I think one thing that I wanted to hear you talk about was this idea that kind of from that point, Randolph Sr., the kind of the family fortune in some way came from basically an insurance fraud, right?
It was a dynasty founded on fraud. It's hard to understand that, but it is actually true. My research bears it out, I believe. What happened was Randolph Sr. was a very powerful man and a very wealthy man until the banks collapsed. And in those days, there was no FDIC insurance. I mean, the banks collapsed in the Low Country, and he lost everything and went deeply into debt. And he also was very ill. He was young. He was relatively young. He was in his early 50s, but he was very ill with heart disease. And then also he had renal failure. There was no solution for that in those days. And it was a miserable way to live, and eventually would cause your death. So he was broke. He was sick. And his son, his son, Randolph Murdoch Jr., who went by Buster, we call him Old Buster, was coming home, had just come home to take over the law firm. So what he did was he had a heart attack in court on the day of a big trial, went to the hospital, and really never started practicing law again. His every movement he made was front page news, so you can track how sick he was. Oh, he's been in the hospital in Savannah for 2 weeks, that kind of thing. Well, in the summer of, it was in July of 1940, the story goes, he was driving home from a poker game south of Hampton, coming back at, midnight, 1 a.m. in his Ford sedan. He turns a couple miles shy of where he lived. He turns right on a very rural dirt road across from an old country cemetery, and drives up to the base of these train tracks. And the train was the lifeblood of Hampton County. It came through multiple times a day. And if you're in Hampton, you can't escape the train. It runs right through the middle of town. So it's a deserted train tracks, clear night, the moon is bright. The train is coming, and it's loaded with freight coming up from Beaufort up to Augusta. And it's bearing down on the train tracks. He drives up on the train tracks, stops the car, leans out the window and waves at the train, and is hit at full force, thrown 900 feet and immediately killed. There was an inquest the next day, which was the process. There was a coroner's inquest. They pull a jury of 10 white men who live within 5 miles of where the wreck happened. Those were the guidelines. So 10 people he knew. The sheriff was a protege of Randolph Murdoch Sr. The coroner was a protege. They owed their jobs to his patronage. They hold this inquest. The engineer comes in and testifies. There is no way. He had to know what he was doing. He was waving. He didn't seem to, there was no effort to jump out of the car. I don't understand why he would do this. And the conductor says the versions of the same thing. I was blowing the whistle. He had to have known we were coming. The jurors put their heads together and say it was a tragic accident, and his car must have stalled. And with that, then his son, who is also a lawyer like his dad, and one of their big parts of their practice in those days was suing the railroad. He sued the railroad in a civil lawsuit for wrongful death. And for, at that time, an unprecedented amount of money, what would be the equivalent of millions of dollars. And the railroad knew about Hampton. They knew about Randolph Murdoch and his son, and they settled. And so the family fortune was completely restored as a result of this train wreck that I believe, and I think the evidence shows, was insurance fraud.
A violent death that at least temporarily solve the family's problems, if you want to foreshadow.
Well, exactly. And that was the reason to go into all the history and the reason to establish Hampton County as a character in the story is because every crime that Alec Murdoch is convicted of, every single one, has an echo in the past. And if you're familiar with Alec Murdoch's story, guess what? He tries to commit insurance fraud by faking his own death on the side of the road, Labor Day of 2021, to claim insurance for his son, but really to sow confusion about the homicides of a couple months earlier.
So now we come to Alec, who, interestingly, in a way I'd not understood previously to reading your book, comes across as a gifted attorney, very influential person there, but also has this sort of childlike quality about him. You talk about how he's sort of addicted to Capri Suns, and would eat Fruity Pebbles for breakfast, and how, in fact, I think an empty container of Capri Sun kind of becomes a clue in the mystery at some point. And how did you see his personality as you got to know him from the trial and from all the research you did?
Well, I think we know him now as such a depraved person, such a, I mean, really a deeply evil person. But I wanted to explore and kind of explain to people why he was able to gain so much trust, why he got so many clients, why he was the, you know, he was, there was a duality there. And particularly in Hampton, where his family was so powerful, he was the prom king at Wade Hampton High School. He was the quarterback of the football team. He dated the prettiest girl. And he was, you know, he was always this kind of, he was nice until he wasn't. And then he was spoiling for a fight often. And you're right, there was a real childlike nature to him. He was 6'4", 265 at his heaviest. He used his size kind of strategically. And you never see him. If you see a picture of him, he's never face to face with a person talking to them. He's always sidled up to them with his arm around their shoulders. And he did have a, there was a part of him that was almost boyish. His favorite snack, like you said, he loved Fruity Pebbles with extra sugar sprinkled on top. Can you imagine? And a key voice in the book is Blanca Simpson, who was the family housekeeper for a number of years. And she kept his house stocked with strawberry milk and his favorite types of Capri Suns. Not any Capri Suns, but he liked Mountain Cooler and he liked orange pineapple. So she always made sure to have, you know, Amazon deliver, you know, like a case of them to Moselle, his home.
In some ways, as I read this book, I had some kind of, I'm not sure if the right word is admiration, just sort of grudging disbelief at Alec Murdoch's time management skills, because he had a lot of stuff going on. So let's move forward a little bit to the point at which people start dying in this story. Could you sort of explain, maybe around whenever that was, what his sort of official jobs were and what sort of scams and frauds he was running kind of behind the scenes?
You know, his day job was as a personal injury lawyer who represented poor people who had something awful happen in their life, a death or dismemberment. And in that part of the world, the Murdochs have this very popular, very successful law firm, and they specialize in wrecks, but also other types of personal injury. And he would take a case, and there would be no upfront fee, but he would take 40% of whatever he was able to get. And because the law firm was so feared, the settlements would often be large. He was making better than $1 million a year in his day job and legitimate income. And many years, many times more than that. So that was what that was like his official job. But it is stunning to think the amount of separate crimes and lies he was able to keep hidden for a better part of a decade. His thefts really started accelerating. He always had kind of like penny ante crimes in the early 2000s when he was starting out in the law firm. He was always, his law partners will tell you, there was always some questionable expenses on his corporate card. He was paying for his son's private school tuition or paying for a vacation, and he would get dinged for that. But mostly it was the small things. But he started stealing from his clients in earnest in the mid 2000s. He had tried to become a real estate investor, like a big wheel in real estate, like his grandfather and his father had done on the side. They had made some investments in waterfront property down and made a lot of money that way. And he wanted to do the same. And like Alec, he always was larger and bigger than anybody that came before him. So he went into real estate in a big way at the wrong time, right before the boom. He went underwater on multiple properties he invested in and had to come up with ways to stay afloat. And that's really when he started stealing from his clients. He would tell them, "You're not going to believe how much money I got for you. I got you $1 million." And you'll be like, $1 million? That is life-changing money. But guess what? He got $3 million. So in addition to taking the 40% that he was owed, he took the delta between what he told him and what he actually got. So he kept those lies separate. He had multiple accounts running at the bank. It was fairly, he was impressive in a way for somebody who gives off sort of an aw shucks small town lawyer feel, the amount of criming he was able to keep separate for a really long time.
And then at some point also began embezzling from his own firm.
He did, and from his own brother. He was also involved in buying copious amounts of pills.
Yeah, I think, yeah, we forgot to top that off. He was basically an opioid addict, right?
He was buying a lot of pills. And originally with the legitimate prescription, he was a college athlete, a walk-on for the football team, and he injured his knee. So he started in the early 2000s taking pills. And then as it got harder to get pills and he needed more and more, he started buying them illegally in, you know, thousands of dollars a month worth. So he was also eventually, you know, charged with trafficking, although there's not a lot of evidence that he was involved in any sort of major drug ring. He was mostly his own use, from what I understand.
So basically, we're talking about a guy who was a mess.
Oh, and we haven't even talked about his, he had multiple women that he was juggling as well and trying to conceal from his wife, Maggie, all of his lies. So he had a lot of balls in the air at any one time. He was in constant motion. His paralegal describes him as, you know, a Tasmanian devil, you know, always spinning, always.
When we come back, Valerie Borlein talks about the endless curiosity over the Murdoch case.
There were people driving from many states away, getting there at 4 and 5 in the morning to get into the courtroom to get a seat. And I would stop and talk to people in the line going in, "Why are you here?" And they say, "I just don't understand. How could he do it? How could a man kill his wife and son?"
That and more ahead on Southbound. Before we get back to this episode, I wanted to ask for a little help with something. If you enjoy Southbound, please give us a good rating and write us a review on Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast provider you have that allows such things. The more reviews and better ratings we get, the better chance there is that other listeners can find us. But to be honest, I'd just as soon you tell people about Southbound through good old word of mouth. If you could recommend it to just one person you know, somebody you might think would enjoy interesting conversations about the South, I'd be deeply grateful. If you have any thoughts about the show, guests to recommend, or anything that you think might make Southbound better, you can email me at ttomlinson@wfae.org. Thanks so much for giving us a little bit of your time. And now, back to my conversation with Valerie Borlein. So I think you make a good point in the book that it's hard to say what the turning point for him might have been because there were so many twists and turns in his story. But I do want to focus on, because you spend a lot of time on, the boat wreck involving his son, Paul. Could you describe what happened there and even more so what happened right after that?
The boat wreck took place on February 24th, 2019. And we talked a little bit about the population of Hampton being 20,000 people since 1900, the four other counties in the circuit that the judicial circuit that the Murdochs ran. One of them is Beaufort. And all of the counties are still roughly 20,000 people, same as they were in the 1900s. When they built the bridge to Hilton Head in the 70s, the population went from 20,000 to 220,000 now. And the wreck that happened in 2019 happened in Beaufort, where a lot of people weren't from there, and the Murdoch name did not have the same pull. So that was a devastating place to have something awful happen, an awful crime committed by your son in a place that you didn't have as much control. And what happened is that Paul Murdoch was 19 years old at the time, already a very troubled young man. He was drinking daily since his early teens. He was sneaking beers out of the family refrigerator when he was, you know, 8 years old, 10 years old. He was a wild man like his dad. He loved to be outdoors and he loved to fight. And Paul had a bad temper. So he was out on his dad's boat going to an oyster roast in February. And with his girlfriend, his on and off again girlfriend, and then two other couples. And they take the boat to this oyster roast down in Beaufort because they knew they were going to drink and they knew there was DUI checkpoint that night. So they got on the boat and drove more than an hour to get to this oyster roast. He drinks all night. He had a blood alcohol level 0.286, so three times the legal limit. He had 19 drinks over the course of the evening. So he was very, very drunk. They're on the way back and he got into a fight with his girlfriend and gets in her face, spits in her face and slaps her. And she's crying. It's a terrible, it's 2 a.m. The friends are cold and wet and sad and upset, and they want to go home. And Paul is yelling and screaming and driving the boats in circles. He's lost it. He slams, right after that fight, he slams down the throttle of the boat, and they start going the equivalent of 29 miles an hour in a narrow little path called Archer's Creek. And he hits a bridge at full speed. Three of the people in the boat go overboard. One is Mallory Beach, who was the girlfriend of another young man on the boat. And she doesn't come up, and she's missing. So the night of the boat wreck is 2:20 in the morning. The cops come, and they are trying to sort through this chaotic scene. It takes them almost an hour to load Paul. He's so drunk and so belligerent to load him into the ambulance. They have to strap him down to hold him in the ambulance because he keeps climbing out. And first person he calls is his grandfather from the phone of one of the other kids on the boat, and says, "Oh, we had a wreck. I was, you know, and Mallory Beach is missing." And he says, "Well, who was driving?" "Oh, it wasn't me. It was this other boy on the boat." And that's the stage where, you know, by the time they get to the hospital, Alec Murdoch and his father, Randolph Murdoch, the long-term solicitor, are beating feet to get down there. I mean, I have their cell phone records. I can tell when he left home and when he got to Beaufort. So he gets to the hospital and starts trying to clean up this huge problem that his son is very drunk, yelling, you know, trying to touch the butt of the nurse. He's a mess. He starts trying to sow confusion there in the emergency room about who was driving. He doesn't need to prove for sure that somebody else was driving, but he needs to, for there to be enough confusion to not be able to prove that his son was. And you can see the security footage. You can see him going room to room, talking to these young people, some of whom the young man that Paul was trying to blame for being the driver was a kid that Alec had coached his little league team. So, you know, it was just the Murdoch way of controlling this situation. And as their history showed, and I hope that you'll see in the book, making a lie look like the truth.
And you give this impression of him as being really frantic, running around trying to fix this thing. I think probably not just for his son's sake, but for his own sake, because he knows if bad things come out about his son, they may eventually lead back to him, and he's going to be, he knows everything that's at stake at that moment, right?
He was an assistant solicitor, volunteer solicitor, so he knows the criminal charges that Paul could be facing. Decades in prison if Mallory Beach dies, and she did drown. So he knows that his son's in huge jeopardy and the family name's in jeopardy. He also knows he's a civil lawyer, right? And he has sued, I've found records where he had sued over boat wrecks. He knew the civil consequences that he might be facing because it was his boat. And it was his son who was drinking underage and using his mother's credit card to buy a lot of the alcohol that night. So he knows that. But he also knows that he has been stealing from his clients for a decade. And if there's any sort of civil lawsuit, he knows that his financials would be subpoenaed. And guess what they would show? Massive amounts of fraud. So he's just got a lot at stake bearing down on him that night in the ER. And his movements just take on so much more meaning when you understand that.
People still have a bit of a hard time understanding, you know, and now we get to the night that everybody knows about where, you know, he's been convicted of murdering his wife and Paul. Why he felt he needed to do that. So in the prosecution's case, or maybe in your theory from having studied this so long as well, why did you feel like he felt like he had to do that?
You know, I think that is the fundamental question. I was in the courtroom every day and there were people driving from many states away, getting there at 4 and 5 in the morning to get into the courtroom to get a seat. And I would ask, stop and talk to people in the line going in, "Why are you here?" And they say, "I just don't understand. How could he do it? How could a man kill his wife and son?" What you have to understand is the pressure that was bearing down on him that day, June 7th of 2021. He was confronted that afternoon by Jeannie Seckinger, the law firm administrator. there was a $792,000 fee that was missing. And he had been putting them off. Oh, I've got it. It's in, you know, it's in the account. It's, you're mistaken. She confronted him. She's like, we have to work. I wouldn't be doing my job if we didn't sort this out. She's talking with him. And it's very rare for somebody in the law firm to confront the fourth generation, you know, scion of the person that founded it, who's, you know, whose name is on the firm. The boat wreck case, he had an antagonist in the family lawyer for Mallory Beach's family, a guy named Mark Tinsley. Mark Tinsley was doing exactly what he had feared, which was subpoenaing all of his financial records. And this is 2021. You know, Alec had been fending off those requests for the better part of 2 years. A judge had finally said, enough. We're having a meeting on this, a hearing on this on June 10th, just a couple of days away, and you need to get your financials in order. So he was at his desk working on that when he was confronted about the missing money. And then gets a call that his father, Randolph Murdoch III, is going to the hospital for what will be the last time. He's been very ill for a number of years with cancer and then also with heart disease, which runs in the family. And his father had been not just his protector, but had loaned him money when he needed it, loaned him $1 million over the course of a couple of years. So all these things were happening that afternoon. And what does he do? You can see, you know, we have his phone records. We can tell you every move he made that day. As soon as he gets that call, he reaches out to Maggie. She's not scheduled to come home that night. She's down at the beach at their beach house and says, I need you to come home. And he lures her back. She doesn't want to, but he lures her back. He calls his son. I need you to come home. You know, Paul was living an hour away with his uncle over the summer and working. So Paul comes home. He lures them home because he needs to avoid detection at all costs for his wrongdoing, but also because that family name was everything. And he loved his wife and son, he loved himself, and he loved his name more.
It strikes me that one of the kind of through lines in the story is how video made such a big difference in the story that he told and the story that ended up being truthful. As you mentioned, there was that scene in the hospital after the boat wreck, which was on the security cameras there, and you can see him sort of going around trying to fix things. One of the key pieces of evidence in his murder trial was a video that Paul had taken just before he and his mom were killed. You know, Alec had said he was nowhere near where they died at the moment. He was way off on another piece of the property, but the video showed that he had been there just minutes before, if that. And it seems like all these technological things that I'm sure he had used many times to his advantage sort of came back to bite him.
You know, it is something, because, and we know in our own experience, and one of the SLED agents said this, you can lie, but your phone can't lie. And it has no reason to. And his phone and the digital records from his vehicle that night, all of that put the lie to what he was saying. And the funny thing, Alec used to tell people he should have been born, he was born a generation too late. He would have liked to live in his grandfather's time because those things didn't exist. There was no electronic records of your emails. There was no, you know, you could say what you want to say happened, and that was the truth because you were Murdoch, and that no longer held. And that video was the linchpin of the homicide case. Because what it meant was, you know, Alec had been saying, the homicides were June 7th, 2021. He'd been saying for the better part of a year that he wasn't down there. And finally, you know, 8-9 months into the investigation, they're able to open Paul's phone, which had been locked. And there's a video on there. You can clearly hear Alec's voice at 8:45 and 45 seconds with his wife and son. You can hear him calling the dog down at the kennels at the exact moment he said he wasn't there, and less than 3 minutes before they died. So it was an immense piece of evidence that changed the trajectory of the whole case.
Do you think he would ever admit that he did it?
You know, I'm not sure he admits it to himself. It is a question that I have in my mind is like, does he even, because, and Judge Clifton Newman, you know, had this extraordinary moment in the sentencing where he talked directly to Alec. It was being in the courtroom, witnessing it, you could have heard a pin drop. I mean, I was sitting behind Mark Tinsley and he said, I realized I wasn't breathing. And then I looked around and I realized nobody else was breathing. It was this dramatic moment. And Judge Newman looks at Alec and he said, you know, he asked him to come clean and to admit it. And he Alex strenuously denied having any involvement in it. And Judge Newman said, it might not have been you. It might have been the monster that you became.
There's so many loose ends here that I hate to try to track them all down, but there are at least three that I can think of sort of unresolved deaths. One is Mallory, the young woman on the boat. One is Gloria Satterfield, the former housekeeper who we haven't even talked about, who wound up dead at the bottom of the steps at the house there. And then there's a young man, Stephen Smith, who may be a friend or acquaintance of some of the family members, who was basically seems to be beaten to death by the side of a road there. And there may be some links to the family there. Do you know if any of those are any closer to being understood or resolved at this point?
The Gloria Satterfield case, Gloria was the longtime housekeeper for the Murdochs for 20 years. She practically raised Paul Murdoch. She fell down the steps at Moselle in 2018 and hit her head and died a few weeks later in the hospital. And Alec robbed her sons, who were like family. They consider him their family. He robbed them of $3 million in an insurance settlement he got from her fall. Gloria's death, there was a second autopsy ordered to find out if there was anything suspicious around the way she fell. Because originally Alec had said she tripped over the dogs, but there was a question of whether she might have been pushed and by whom. I talked recently with her family lawyer, and that autopsy was never conducted. The family is relatively at peace with the idea that she had some sort of medical event. She was in poor health and had some sort of fading spell earlier in the week where she had a minor fender bender as a result. So they feel like she had either a stroke or passed out or had some sort of thing that caused her fall. In terms of Mallory Beach, there's an ongoing civil case involving the boat wreck and the, you know, kind of the, all the different tentacles of that. I speak regularly with her family, and they felt some measure of justice that with Alec's conviction. You know, they knew Paul. They'd known Paul his entire life, and they felt some relief. There was some vindication, you know, that Paul and Maggie, he was held responsible for their deaths as well. But in terms of Stephen Smith, that is the big unanswered question. We don't know who killed this young man, 19-year-old nursing student, left him in the middle of the road. And like everything in Hampton County, there's a connection to the past. It was Sandy Run Road. It was a road, a rural, very country road that was actually paved 100 years ago with a generous donation from Randolph Murdoch Sr. But there, we don't know who killed Stephen Smith. That investigation is very active, actually. And I think the grand jury is still trying to sort through who's responsible for killing this young man.
And do you feel like Alec's conviction broke the spell in some way that family had over that place? Obviously, there are some family members who are still alive, still living there. Do you feel like their grip has been broken somehow? Or what's it like there now?
I do feel like the spell has been broken in some regards. I have several people I now consider friends, people that I stay in touch with, and especially with the book coming out, I'm checking in with them regularly. And there is a sense of almost relief. A contact of mine wrote me a note earlier this week and just said, you know, I'm glad that everyone in the world knows what we always knew to be the case. The difficult turn of that is that when there's a collapse in the power structure, it leaves a vacuum. Hampton County is really struggling now as much as they ever were. The county manager, who was a protege of the Murdochs, she was recently charged with embezzlement. There is a significant amount of money, millions of dollars, that was meant to go for a big softball park. It was a referendum that passed, and people without a lot of money agreed to additional taxes to get this big softball place. And that money's missing in the county government. So there is a real sense of loss there, and sort of that they're still reeling from being under the grips of one family for 100 years, but B, the subject of so much intense scrutiny, and feeling someone under siege for now 3 years. And then also the lack of cohesion in what happens next.
You're in the middle of this. You cover this case for years, a journalist doing your job. Now that the book is out, you're talking about it and that sort of thing. It's maybe a time of reflecting on this. How did being in the middle of all this for so long, how did it change you?
I am changed. You know, I've had a lot of people ask me whether it was too heavy or too bleak. And there's no doubt that his crimes were horrific and emotionally violent to people who, I mean, motherless girls, you know, a paraplegic, deaf teenager. He robbed the least of these. It's abominable. And people have said, how did you live with such bleak material? But, you know, what's really fascinating to me and what I try to lean into in the book is the number of people that took huge risk to try to unravel this system. And it's just like Mr. Rogers said, you know, look for the helpers. I spent a lot of my time talking with Creighton Waters, the prosecutor, who's devoted years of his life to proving this vast criminal, you know, conspiracy of Elix. A key voice in the book is Mark Tinsley, the attorney for the Beaches. David Owen, the SLED agent, who was a lead agent, was very generous with his time and had not talked really with others. And more than that, many of the women in the family, part that were close to the family, like Blanca Simpson, the housekeeper, or Shelley Smith, there were many people that took risk to call out what they saw. That part was enriching to me to see.
The title of Valerie Borland's book comes from the Cormac McCarthy novel, Blood Meridian. Here's the full quote. "You can find meanness in the least of creatures, but when God made man, the devil was at his elbow, a creature that can do anything." Alec Murdoch, turns out, was a creature capable of anything. He stole from his destitute clients. He perverted the law for its own means. And in the end, he lured his wife and son to their vast empty property and killed them in the misguided hope that their deaths would divert attention from all his other crimes. What you come away with after reading Valerie's book is that he was more than just a single evildoer. He was the product of a family that ruled Hampton County for a century, their own little Dixie Mafia. He was born into power and lawlessness and raised to act in the Murdoch way. Looking back, it feels like it was bound to fall apart. But maybe not. Maybe we would never know about Alex Murdoch if his son had not wrecked his boat two counties and a whole world away, where the Murdoch name did not matter. As Valerie said, that name meant everything to the Murdochs. And now, because of Alec, it means something completely different to the rest of us. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our editors are Lisa Wharf and Jen Lang. Our main theme music comes from Joshua Lee Turner. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, the NPR app, or wherever else you listen to podcasts. Subscribe for free to get each new episode sent to you when it's ready. You can also find Southbound on our website. Just go to wfae.org/podcast/southbound. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.